Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Marigold Clothing, making fashion fun since 1989, in Broad Ripple, featuring women's clothing, gifts, and accessories, and committed to customer service. More on Facebook or at marigoldclothing.com. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by eatdrinkindy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are talking about inspiration and ideas. Ideas that have grown from a conversation into something big. For the biggest of this week's big ideas, we'll talk with farmer, entrepreneur, and now restaurant owner Chris Baggett of Tyner Pond Farm and The Mug in Greenfield. He'll tell us about his new venture called Cluster Truck, a new food delivery concept inspired by food trucks. Then we'll talk with local canning enthusiast Dee Alderman about turning her expertise into a business and about how Graham's Jams has helped her reshape her life after being sidelined by an injury. And we'll also hear from two friends who have grown a knife-making hobby into a business and brought their handcrafted knives to farmers markets. Eric Giesman and Eric Smith tell us how they launched Ash Blades. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Farmer and entrepreneur Chris Baggett is becoming a force in local food. Since leaving Compendium and before that Exact Target, the former software entrepreneur has launched Tyner Pond Farm, which raises animals on pasture, and The Mug, a farm-to-fork drive-in restaurant, both in Greenfield, Indiana. There are more restaurants and a market on the way, but it's his food truck-inspired delivery business that we're talking about today. Cluster Truck offers different types of food, all prepared in a central kitchen, and then Uber-type drivers deliver it. There's a variety of menus, like you'd find at a gathering of food trucks, or a cluster truck, as it's called. So imagine a virtual gathering of food trucks, but with delivery. That's what Cluster Truck is. Chris tells us how the idea came about.
So the food truck concept came up because, you know, they're wildly popular mentally. There's an image that it is like this creative, aggressive street food. It's going to be interesting and things like that. What I learned, actually talking with Matt Kornmeyer, who was when the trucks are together, they do more business. So if a truck is out, it will do some business. And if they're together and there's 6 or 10 trucks in an event called a cluster truck, they will do collectively much, much better individually. And that gets you thinking about, you know, people love the food, but people want to eat different things, right? So the variety of, you know, you're going to go and I'm going to get a cheeseburger and you're going to get a pad thai bowl or something like that. And we're both going to go get a cupcake. You know, that's that people want that variety and choice. So that got me down the lines of the food truck. I was thinking about marketing. So as we talked about, like the Grubhub model and selling into these small businesses, restaurants. And I'd be like, why would the restaurant do this when it's such a bad deal for them? And it's being sold to them as a marketing play, right? And I remember that at Exact Target, we printed Groupons when Groupon first came out. And Groupon was another one that went into these small businesses and sold their program to them saying, we're going to bring you all this new business. You give them these massive coupons and we'll bring you new customers. And it took a couple of years where they were very successful at Groupon for the small business to realize that this was bad. So then I was like, okay, if people are using Groupon because they think it's a good marketing tool, and most restaurants are bad marketers, most small businesses are bad marketers, they're just busy. It doesn't make them bad people. It's just they've got a lot of hats to wear. Who are the best marketers? And that's how I got onto the food trucks, because I thought the food trucks, you know, by definition, they have to have a direct relationship with the customer. I've got to tell you where I am today, you know.
Right. So social media, right?
So social media, right. And again, that direct connection with the customer. So the idea originally was we will license the food truck recipes, which then I thought of it as a record label where you go play the concert, right? But lots of people can't come to the concert, but they still want to hear the song, and we'll give you a nickel every time that song's played, and we'll play it to your standards, and you know, and that will work great. And so that's kind of how the food truck idea came around. We wanted to have that broad variety. We wanted this interesting food, and I thought that the food trucks would help me market. So now every time that a food truck is out there, you know, hey, we're going to be blah, 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 Indian food, and we'll be on the corner of 10th and Delaware, but if you can't make it, order from Cluster Truck.
Right. So that was the concept. Like, you were going to have the delivery of all these food trucks.
So we would make in our kitchen. It wouldn't be made in the food truck. We would basically license their recipes and make the food here.
Right. So that was the original concept.
Exactly. And then as we started to flesh that out and try and turn it into reality, you know, we ran into a bunch of problems. A lot of food trucks didn't want to work with us. Other food trucks, there's a lot of overlap. So, you know, we had a lot of one kind of food and nobody in Indianapolis is making Mexican food. So then we realized that, you know, that probably wasn't going to scale. Food trucks come and go, right? They might be open one year and gone the next. So there's a lot of inconsistency there as well. So then we thought, well, what if we just go with the food truck theme and have all these food truck style foods, but we will make all the food ourselves and we will come up with our own recipes and things like that. And then, you know, we sort of have a hybrid here now because we do have some known restaurants participating. And I think that will help us from a marketing standpoint, you know.
Like Scratch Truck, right?
Right, Scratch Truck. We're not launching with their food, though, in this mm-hmm. round. But the other nice thing about the business model with Cluster Truck is we can spin up or spin down concepts daily. You know, so we can license Scratch Truck and say, okay, for 3 weeks, you know, we're going to be making this. Or we can license a food truck in Austin, Texas. That's the coolest food truck in the world, and pay them and say, we want to license your food in Cluster Truck and make it. Or we can hire Alan at Cerulean to come in and, hey, this weekend we're going to have the Cerulean menu at Cluster Truck. You know, so we have the mug, we have Brew Burger, and, you know, Chris Ely called me from Goose Market. I was like, you know, it just struck me. We were thinking about starting a delivery business for our sandwiches, but why don't you know, make our sandwiches? And so we're going to do that. So, you know, and this is wet cement. We're going to play around with it and find exactly the right model. But, you know, making all of our own food for the most part, being able to share ingredients, you know, have kind of common methodologies. And, you know, you will see our chicken pop up in 6 or 7 different things, you know, but it's the same original source chicken versus, you know, hamburgers were a different problem. You know, I've got these Tyner Pond grass feds, Tyner Pond corn feds, Brew Burger is all Creekstone. You know, Scratch Burger is a third brisket, a third chuck, a third, you know, so, you know, you start getting into all these nuances of everybody's recipe and it just became unworkable.
So you have the central kitchen.
Right.
But it's the delivery system that's what's really cool. So
right,
tell me
right.
a little bit about that.
Right. I mean, the whole software system is really interesting because, again, as you look at the entire process of food delivery, you know, you have a lot of moving parts. You have the customer. You have the driver. You have the restaurant making the food. You have the process of the food being made in the restaurant. So what we tried to do is build a seamless system that basically is timing out every item and the driver and the customer so that we deliver food that is the freshest possible. You know, if you think about pizza as one example, why is pizza so successful at delivery and a hamburger isn't? Well, because a pizza can live for 45 minutes and not be terrible. A hamburger 10 minutes later is going to be a miserable experience, right? And a lot of that is because nobody knows where the driver is, right? So you call your local pizza place and order your pizza, they're probably going to make the pizza. And the driver is nowhere to be found. They don't know if he's 5 minutes away or 15 minutes away or 20 minutes away. So you know you live 3 minutes from the pizza place. You know the pizza takes 6 minutes to make, and yet it's 45 minutes to get to your house. That's a driver problem, right? So in our model, first thing we'll do is when you click the button on your app, we'll find the driver. Driver will accept the job and will immediately know where he is and how long before he gets to the kitchen. Then we also know every item in the kitchen, how long it's going to take to make. So let's say we have a 7-minute item like chicken wings, a 4-minute item like a cheeseburger, and a 2-minute item that might be soup. And, you know, so when he gets from his 12 minutes away to the 7-minute line, we tell them, who's ever cooking the chicken wings, start chicken wings. He doesn't know anything else except he's making chicken wings. Then, 3 minutes after that, at the 4-minute line, we tell the burger people to make hamburger, right, and however you want it. And then at the 30-second line, somebody's scooping the soup, right? There's no ticket based on the customer. It's all just firing the items at the right time. What's really cool about the system is that it will get smart based on all kinds of, you know, we call them in the software business algorithms, but, you know, the math of things. We can make a pizza in 3.5 minutes, but we can only make 2 in that 3.5 minutes. So that means the third pizza that comes in is going to be 7 minutes back, and the 12th pizza is going to be 20 minutes back. So suddenly I've got my driver, and you've ordered your pizza and chicken wings. You know, an hour ago I might have started the chicken wings first. Now I'm going to have to start the pizza first, you know, get that thing ready and prepped, and then, you know, get everything. But the whole idea is all the food is going to come together at the end just as the driver's pulling up, so that we hand him a package and he delivers it to you in our delivery zone is about 5 to 6 minutes tops. So from the time that food is finished, it still might have taken 25 or 35 minutes, but that food is going to be only 5 minutes old when it gets into your hands.
We've been talking with farmer and entrepreneur Chris Baggett of Tyner Pond Farm and now Cluster Truck. Stay with us for more from Chris here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Everybody does it, right? Just about everybody orders delivery, at least occasionally. And some people, maybe especially at lunchtime, order it a lot. Several businesses now offer delivery from a variety of local restaurants, but one local business has completely reimagined the way food delivery works. Farmer and former software entrepreneur Chris Baggett of Tyner Pond Farm and The Mug in Greenfield is launching Cluster Truck, a food delivery service inspired by a gathering of food trucks. But unlike traditional delivery from a regular restaurant, Cluster Truck prepares all the food from a variety of menus in a central kitchen and uses drivers to deliver it. It's as if you're choosing from a variety of food trucks all in one place. Chris explains how Cluster Truck works and how it will get the food to diners fast.
They're Uber-style drivers, so they can work for any of these services, and most of them work for all of them. And so they're freelancers, and they will use our app and freelance with us just as well. What's nice about the system is that food delivery seems to be in lulls of passenger delivery. You know, there's not a lot of lunchtime Uber work here. There's a lot of right-after-work Uber work. So somebody can be doing right-after-work Uber work, doing lunch with us, and then there's going to be a lull of 6, 7, 8 o'clock, which is dinner time, where there's not a lot of passenger activity, but there's a lot of food activity. So we really think we'll fill in the gaps nicely. And the way our model is, the driver doesn't have to ever get out of the car. The customer will meet the car and pick up the food from the car, and they don't have to get out of the car at the restaurant. We will bring the food to them in the car. So they drive up, we hand them the food, they get to the customer's 4 or 5 minutes away, so the customer's getting an alert, you know, hey, he's 2 minutes away, hey, he's 1 minute away, he'll be pulling up in 15 seconds, you walk out, you take your bag, and you go back in, and the driver goes on, and we want the drivers to be able to do lots of laps. You know, one of the real pain points in the current food delivery system is for the poor driver who has to go to the restaurant, park his car, get out of the car, walk into the restaurant, hope their food's done, fight their way, wait their turn, get their food, walk back out, hope they didn't get a ticket, get back in their car, go find the customer, log into an apartment building. You know, they can get 1 or 2 jobs an hour done, right? So in our model, they should be able to get 4 to 6 jobs an hour done. So they'll make a lot more money. In fact, they should make a lot more money than even driving passengers and things like that, because we really want to make it driver friendly.
So this is all figuring out the process, right?
Right, exactly.
The process and then how to streamline it.
You know, Jolene, I use this analogy a lot because I used to be in the catalog business, and Sears was one of my clients, you know, back in the 80s. And we all know, people our age anyway, you know, Sears invented the model of shipping everything, right? They were the everything store.
Sure.
for 150 years. When the internet came along, they and all the other catalog companies just kind of bolted it onto the side of their business. Oh, here's another channel. But it caused friction. They couldn't do it well for some reason. Amazon came along and said, if I'm building this from the ground up as only an internet business, how would I build it? And so they got this gigantic advantage from the brick and mortar and the old fashioned catalog companies that should have won in the internet, right? They had the inventory, they had the warehouses, they had the product that people liked, but they didn't win because they could not build a streamlined system for the internet only. And that's really the way we look at it. All the food delivery companies, even Uber, you know, and Uber Eats is still working within the existing restaurant infrastructure. And it's always going to be an add-on, and it's never going to work. And, you know, we're thinking of the entire soup-to-nut process, vertically integrated, internet-only business, virtual restaurant.
So it's a virtual cluster truck.
Right, exactly, with a T.
So tell me when it launches.
Thursday the 17th, we did a little bit of what we call UI practice. We had folks come in and just work through the app and just tell me what they didn't like, where did they get stuck, things like that. Tomorrow we are doing... I think we have five companies identified that we're delivering food to. And that will just sort of test out packaging, and the kitchen's going to make everything. And then the customer will obviously get to taste the food. So we're doing it in places like Tinderbox and Lesson Lee and Salesforce and High Alpha, where you know, people will give us feedback on that. Then Monday, we start launching what we call beta testers, where we will have a very controlled launch. We've got a list of about 600 or 700 people who have signed up, and everyone's going to get free food next week. And the first day we'll have a small segment that will be very controlled. You can order from these two trucks at these certain times, and, you know, kind of test and put pressure on the kitchen that way. That'll be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we'll build up to Wednesday, where we'll kind of open it up to all the beta testers to order whatever they want, whenever they want. We're going to try to do 300 meals that day, and then Thursday we go live. So Thursday the 24th, if everything goes well through the next week, Thursday the 24th will be our first day in business.
Wow. What do you expect?
I think it's going to go pretty well. You know, my real worry is, you know, some of the uncontrollables we have in this, A, will the customer come to the car? Right? They have to. So, and that's our trade-off. We have free delivery. So that's kind of our bargain with the customer, and I think they will. Uber Eats makes you come to the car, and everyone seems to be doing that without too much fuss. The other wild card is there's no line, you know. So, you know, what I don't know is at 12 o'clock noon, do 200 people hit the button at the exact same time, right? And so suddenly, you know, in that millisecond that everyone hits the button at the same time, that 200th person might be an hour and a half out. I don't, you know, so, you know, that, unlike a restaurant, or if you line up at Chipotle or Qdoba where you know where you are in this line, and it's all linear, we have a difficult time controlling that. So, you know, we've got to be very surge, if you will. And, you know, we've talked about surge pricing and things like that. But, you know, I mean, and you know, it's not that far-fetched. We're not going to do it to start. But if the reality is 200 people order at noon, and I can say, hey, you know, you'll save 15% if you order at 12:10, you know, I think, you know, there's, again, it's software. There's a way we can kind of control that supply and demand. But it'll be a good problem to have. But you remember the first day of the mug, you know, it was, and we couldn't control that. This we can control. You know, if we run out of, you know, we can control our pace of pizzas. So, you know, if pizzas get 20 minutes behind, we'll take pizza off the menu. And it may only be off the menu for 10 minutes. Because all of a sudden the timing of pizza goes back to 4 minutes, then, you know, we'll put pizza back on the menu. So there's a lot of levers we can pull with technology that you can't pull, you know, in real life. You know, if you remember the mug, I mean, we had to close at noon near 1 o'clock, you know, the first week, which was a great problem, but also makes a lot of people mad when they drive all the way out there. And so anyway, so those are kind of the things that are keeping me up at night.
We've been talking with farmer and entrepreneur Chris Baggett about Cluster Truck. For more information on the new food delivery service, look for Cluster Truck on Facebook.
We're talking about ideas and inspiration today here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio. And ideas come in all sizes and they show up in all sorts of ways. Indianapolis resident and canning enthusiast Dee Alderman was sidelined by a brain injury in 2007 and, as she puts it, she was hiding out at home until her daughter called her out on that. That inspired Dee to get back to school for more training, and when she needed a way to pay for it, friends pushed her to start selling the homemade jams she'd been giving as Christmas presents. Now her Graham's Jams are available at local farmers markets and by mail order, and Dee tells us just how it all happened.
I had had an accident in 2007 that left me with a traumatic brain injury. I couldn't go back to my prior career of accounting because I couldn't be bonded with a head injury. My youngest daughter wanted to quit something that she had signed up for, and I told her that she couldn't because that would be making excuses and a cop-out, and she asked me if that wasn't what I was doing by hiding out at home.
My goodness, what your daughter said. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I know. because it really was. I really was. I had aphasia with it, so I wouldn't go anywhere without my husband because he would save me. So I went and decided I couldn't be a hypocrite, and I went to Ivy Tech, and I enrolled in classes. And in order, because the head injury left me with a 7th grade math level, to graduate on time, I needed to take summer classes. And I asked my friends, how could I brainstorm raising money to pay for it? And they said, the jam you give us at Christmas, why don't you sell it?
So how long had you been making this jam?
I've made jam for decades. Where I come from in the country, you don't, like, buy jam. The only jam that you don't make is what you trade because other people have different fruit. So, you know, it was just something I did. And I was really surprised when the people in the city didn't have any experience with homemade jam.
So they had never made jam, right?
No, they hadn't made it. And I've tried to talk some of them through how to do it, and they're like, well, just buy yours. So that first couple of years, I just sold to my friends in my mom's group, and they convinced me to go to a farmer's market, which 3 years ago I did.
Okay, so now that seems like kind of a leap of faith, right?
Huge. If my husband hadn't been so supportive of what I was doing, I don't know that I would have done it, because the injury took a lot of wind out of my sails on confident, or out of my, you know, confidence level. And so I put together, you know, a plan on how to do the business. And even though I was a home-based vendor, I still operated it like a business. And then finally it just grew. And last year we did a couple of more markets, and I went commercial in October. So now we're registered with the state and all the proper, everything we need to do to be a business. And so now we're just plugging away.
And now tell me about the business. So it's Graham's Jams, right?
Yes. Yes. We were trying to figure out a name for it because in the beginning, all my friends just kept calling it Dee's Jellies and Jams. So we let my kids and my grandkids try to come up with a name. And my son wanted to call it Graham's Jam and Jams. And his sisters are like, let's tone that down just a little bit.
So no Jam and Jams?
No, just Jams. So, and that's what we've been. So, and it just kind of snowballed from there.
So now how do you go about building a business around the jams that you make that it's just, you know, been something you've always done?
Well, I actually started with just traditional jams. And then people would ask me to experiment with different things. So now in the winter, we play with different flavors, and I have a group of people. Some of them are in the culinary, some of them aren't, some of them are kids, and they taste my concoctions to see what works. And we've had some epic failures, but we've had some pretty good ones too.
Is there something that doesn't work? What would be an epic failure?
We tried to make Cabernet Sauvignon jelly.
Well, it sounds like a good idea.
Except that it's far too sweet. It was really bad. And we also did, for some kids, I was asked to do like a watermelon. Okay. So we did it with Jell-O. And it was, loved it or hated it, and more people hated it. So we, yeah, I ended up, the people that loved, I just gave it to them. But then we've had some really, really neat ones that have taken off. Raspberry Moscato is one of my popular ones. I had a friend, it's actually a neighbor, who his mother-in-law brought them cherry jalapeno from Arizona, and he doesn't like cherries. So he asked me if I could make it in jalapeno in my triple berry, which the triple berry in and of itself is just, it was the leftover strawberry, blueberry, and blackberries that I didn't want to waste. So I thought I was making jam just for us. And somebody got a hold of it, and they loved it, so it had to go in. And then my neighbor was like, will you put jalapenos in the triple berry? And I'm like, I'll try it, but if it doesn't turn out, you have to buy all of them. And now it's huge. People cook with it. They use it on brie or on cream cheese, and that has now expanded into strawberry jalapeno, which won at the state fair 2 years ago.
Oh, how very cool. That's nice.
I know. The lady that was there, she said normally, because it was my first year entering, and I didn't know their unwritten rules, and she said that it was the first time in her memory that a non-plain strawberry had placed in the strawberry category, because I didn't know you were supposed to put it and make your own. So we took fourth place in the strawberry category, and then we also, this year we came out with a strawberry habanero.
Oh my goodness, now that sounds very hot.
It can be, but at New Year's somebody suggested we mix it with a dip, and we used a dip of equal parts of butter, cream cheese, and brie, and put it in a crock pot and served it on crisps with the strawberry habanero. And you can taste the fruitiness of the habanero peppers, which I didn't think was possible. And it wasn't set your mouth on fire hot either. Alone, it's a little spicy, but not with the dip.
Now, how do you come up with the with your varieties of jams?
We just play. If somebody asks if I could, if I ever heard of something, we'll give it a shot. Like right now, I'm working on a recipe for a blackberry vanilla bean bourbon. And we're working on a cherry bourbon, and then because I have a friend who is desperately loves Patron, we're working on a marmalade called Tequila Sunrise.
Now, that sounds very interesting.
It's got, of course, oranges and good quality tequila. We're still kind of tweaking some of the other, other ingredients to get it to set right. Because that one doesn't use pectin. So it just, they have to be balanced or it doesn't work. So, you know, it's trial and error. Thankfully, you can make small recipes that take just 4 or 5 jars until you figure it out.
Did you ever think that your jam making would turn into a business like this?
I honestly never thought it would go beyond making strawberry for my family. I really didn't. And I was shocked. And the 3 years ago, I had somebody made an order that didn't work out, and the mom stepped in, and in like a month and a half, they ordered like 500 jars that I had to get to them for Christmas. They were giving them as teacher gifts, and it just exploded, and I was stunned. So now we regularly get approached to donate for school raffles and things like that, but I had no idea that it would ever become of anything like this.
We've been talking with local canning enthusiast Dee Alderman of Graham's Jams. For more information, look for Graham's Homemade Jams on Facebook. About ideas and inspiration today on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, and I discovered this week that so many ideas are connected somehow to local food. And while it might seem like a stretch, an interview with two local knife makers convinced me that the story of Ash Blades really is a local food story. In fact, I first noticed the artisan knife makers at a local farmer's market. And then once I saw the knives made by Eric Gieseman and Eric Smith, and when I tried them for myself, I could easily see the connection Ash Blades has to local food.
So you are part of the food community, right?
We think we are.
Yeah, we absolutely think we're part of the food community. You know, we like to say that we have local tools for local food. There's a really neat groundswell, I feel like, that's happening around here between, you know, local artisans and vendors and trying to put people back in kitchens. And, you know, that's the big thing is that people aren't cooking anymore. So if we can entice people to get back into the kitchen and make food preparation enjoyable instead of a chore, that's a win for everybody.
Now, tell me again how this came about and how you decided that you're going to learn how to make knives.
Yeah. So, really it was a conversation, but a little bit before that, it was something that I'd been sharpening knives by hand for a little while. I was just really disappointed with the level of sharpness that I could get on the standard kind of just factory bought, store bought stuff. And as I was sharpening and I just sharpened more and more knives, I started getting a feeling about, man, I think I would just like a better knife even than what I have. You know, what does it take to make a knife? And so I did some research and then one Christmas party, we were sitting at the kitchen counter drinking a bourbon and I just said, you know, I think I want to make a knife. I don't know what you think about that. It's totally a random thing to bring up to a friend. Let's make a knife. I was like, I think I want to make a knife. And I didn't expect him. Everybody, I mean, I told some family members and they were just like, okay. I told him and he was like, let's do this. So,
yeah, kind of an interesting concept, hobby. But truthfully, I have a bit of an addictive personality. So when someone floats an idea to me, I want to get all into it. And that's what happened. Like, it became a conversation. Mm-hmm. And then it became hours every day of conversation and not getting work done at work because we were having conversations. I mean, it just became this thing where it was like, okay, I think we could actually do this. Yeah. And so over the course of months, and I mean, truthfully, obviously we're still learning and we're never going to stop learning, but you know, we got to a point where we're like, this isn't half bad.
Yeah.
And so that's where this whole idea was like, well, maybe we could take these to market because we were getting really positive response. You know, people really latched onto it. But, you know, it's bringing that a step back for me, you know, just working in an office environment so much, I don't feel like I could put my efforts into something at the end of the day. I can look at the final product and say, I did this. And so it's really neat to be able just to start with a bunch of random pieces of raw material and convert it into something that not only is beautiful, but is functional and it functions better than anything I've ever had in my kitchen.
How long does it take? How long did it take from when you said, I'm going to learn how to make knife, to now you're making knives to order for chefs?
This is about a 3-year endeavor at this point. It was a little slow going at first because it was a hobby. That's probably an important point to make. Mm-hmm. You know, we could only put an hour or so in a week really in trying to make a knife. And a knife can take 10, 15 plus hours to make. So you can imagine you don't make very many very quickly when you can only spend a couple of hours a week. But then, like Eric said, we ended up making a few that were good enough that people thought, man, maybe, you know, you could probably sell one of those. And so in earnest, we're talking about a little over a year that we've really been making a lot, just making as many knives as we can make and getting them out there for people to try. And then maybe 8 months worth of orders, probably something like that. I don't even think we've sold knives for a year.
How long did that first knife take to make, and how was that first knife? How'd it come out?
They're so ugly. They're awful.
Looked about like that.
But before, yeah. But we were so excited. We actually set the bevels with a file before we heat treated them, and we heat treated them in old motor oil. I made a forge out of a map torch and a paint can that I lined with ceramic wool, and we just, you know, stuck chunks of what we thought were knife-like objects in this forge and heated them up until you touch it with a magnet, and that's how you know a simple steel, a fairly simple carbon steel is at the temperature where it can be quenched, is when you touch a magnet and it won't stick. That's called the critical temperature. And so we're just poking it with magnets until it was the temperature it needed to be, and then quenched it. And then we used this old woodworking 4x36 or whatever grinder.
Yep,
and just hours and hours of grinding and grinding and grinding until we could cut a cardboard box, and we were so
flipped out.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. We jumped up and down and hugged each other. We did it. We've done it. Yeah, it was hilarious.
Yeah, they're terrible. I have it over there. It's the, you know, it's, it, it, and in fact, I still use cardboard because it still does that. it's awful. The hand is just, the handle is giant and it's oddly shaped. And, I mean, the blade shape is okay, but yeah, I mean, it took us probably two solid weekends.
Yeah.
I mean, yep. Every bit of like yep. 20 hours probably to figure it out. And we had,
what was that like though when you did figure it out?
Oh, it was amazing. Really the hardest part, honestly, the absolute panic moment was the handles. Because, you know, imagine trying to align, you know, the pin material across a piece of steel that is no longer soft. You're not drilling through that. Mm-hmm. And then two pieces of wood. We've never done anything like that before. And so, and then you have this slow set epoxy, but it'll hold like a couple tons. And so if you're not fast enough, then things are gluing up that are not ready to go together. And it was panic. It was bedlam. Just trying to get these things stuck together in a shape that I think the second knife I made, one of the pins didn't go through. And the closest thing to me was a bamboo skewer because it was like right by the grill. And so I just grabbed that and like jammed that in there and just snapped it off at the end. I didn't care. It was just going to be like a, you know, it's just a test knife. But that's always been one of the hardest parts. Just an absolute panic moment. Mm-hmm. Oh, these don't align. What do we do? Fix something, you know?
So we've obviously altered our process to do some dry fitting before we mess with the glue up. So
that's where the learning part comes in. But for the first knife, it was terrifying. That bit was. But then once it was all done and everything, I mean, again, we loved them. We loved them. Now we look back at them and they're hideous. But when you first make it, you know, I mean, it's like anything. It's almost brings you back to being a kid when you think you've made something. You know, you build a tree fort or whatever, and you got some rusty old nails and a couple of boards, and you bang them into a tree, and you're just like, yes, this is amazing. I've never had anything like this before. So the first time you make something like that, it was super exciting. But we knew we had so much to learn. There was so much to learn to make them legitimate and, you know, worth selling. But
what do people say when you tell them that you make knives, or what did they say when you said, I'm going to learn how to make knives?
It's an interesting conversation, and truthfully, it depends on who you talk to. My brother-in-law, who is Mr. Outdoorsy, he was like, when do I place my order, because I want a knife. But, you know, other people, it's like, but you don't do that. You work in a cube. So it's just kind of guiding that conversation. So, yeah, it really depends on who you talk to. But we've had a lot of support and a lot of interest. And that's been the neat thing, though, is to be able to continually have conversations. There's a guy at work I'm thinking of who, for the last 2 years, I've been working on him to try to order a knife. And then he finally came to me last week and said, you know, I made some soup for a bunch of people last week. And after about 20 minutes, my hand was hurting. I said, man, I can help you out. He's like, I know. Now that I know that you make knives. So it's becoming less strange to people.
It's a lot of it's about exposure.
That's it.
When most people walk up on us at a market, they have never seen a handmade knife. The vast majority of people. We have some return customers, and they always are excited to see whatever we have. But most people have never seen one, including our families. Our families have been very supportive. I mean, we wouldn't be anywhere near where we are if our families weren't supportive. They were, you know, they love them. Every knife they see, they're like, this is amazing. What you guys do is amazing. This is awesome. Keep going. But yeah, some people are, you know, they're a little skeptical or just sort of bewildered. Why would you make a knife? Yeah. Like, I can buy a perfectly good knife in a blister pack in Walmart. I mean, you can't, but, you know, people are surprised by that. Yeah, they think they can. I mean, it's okay. It's serviceable. Don't get me wrong. It's serviceable. But yeah, it's a mix of excitement, surprise. Excitement's the one, obviously, that's a lot of people, when they pick it up and they try it, they're just blown away by how much different it is than their knives. And that's what we go for. That's when it feels really good, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been really neat to be able to tell that story with people, because especially at the farmers markets, we'll see people walking by our booth and just giving us this look like, what is happening over there?
Right.
And so it's been neat to be able to say, yeah, just come here, let's talk, you know? And so
grab
this carrot. Yeah, grab that carrot, take that knife, and then that look of, whoa, I didn't know a knife could do that. Yes, it can. And yes, we did that. So
yes. Yeah. I think that is so cool, and I think that's the beauty of you being at farmers markets. Now, did that idea come to you easily? Did you decide, you know, early on that that's how you would sell them?
Yeah. Well, so honestly, the idea came as a sort of a step stool because, again, I had already been doing sharpening for years. And what we thought is, well, there at the time when you searched for knife sharpening in Indianapolis, you were lucky to find anything. I mean, there were maybe two around somewhere in and around the city that you could find, but nowhere, no one out here was doing it that we were aware of. So we thought, well, I mean, I know how to sharpen a knife, so we could at least offer that. And while we're there, then, you know, we'll start bringing our knives and we'll see. We'll get a feel for what people think about them.
Okay, now I have to ask, this is the, you know, the $20,000 question. How much do your knives cost? What kind of a price point can people expect?
Sure. Well, we can kind of limit this to kitchen knives, mm-hmm. if that's all right. They will typically start at $175 for a paring knife. So 3.5 inch, 4.5 inch blade, probably about 8 inches overall. And they can go up to $450, honestly, depending on, you know, this gyto we made for this chef, you know, a 9.5 inch blade, super long, super mean, super lean. That's what that's going to run. But we've talked about the petite chef, and that's that 6.5, 7 inch knife that's really popular. And right now, those are going for about $300.
We've been talking with local knife makers Eric Gieseman and Eric Smith of Ash Blades. Stay with us for more about the artisan knife makers here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Inspiration. When it comes to food, the local community is full of great ideas. It's taking those ideas and making them come to life that's tough. I was inspired this week by two local knife makers who in the past year have launched Ash Blades and who are already making knives for local chefs and home cooks as well. Knife makers Eric Gieseman and Eric Smith launched Ash Blades out of a garage workshop and now sell their artisan knives and offer knife sharpening at the Indy Winter Farmers Market. I got a look inside that garage workshop this week and found out just how Eric and Eric go about making Ash Blades artisan knives.
Actually, the most common question that we get is, what do I get? I want a knife, but what do I get? And where we typically start is, number one, obviously, are we talking about a kitchen knife or a field knife? If it's a field knife, there's a different kind of question. Are we hunting with it? Are we camping with it? Are we, you know, what are we doing? But if it's a kitchen knife, well, what kitchen knife do you use right now? And what kind of food do you prepare? Because really what you want, if you're going to buy a handmade knife, whether it's from us or from anyone, what you really want is the knife that you're going to use the most, because it's going to be probably the most finely tuned knife in your kitchen. So don't run off and buy a boning knife if you've never used a boning knife, right? Buy a chef knife. Or if you're my grandmother and all you use a paring knife, buy a paring knife, you know. Or if you prepare a lot of Japanese cuisine and what you want is a nigiri, then buy a nigiri. But buy the knife that you're going to get the most use out of. That's the place to start. And that's where the design questions start.
Now, is the design questions that you mentioned, you know, you have to ask people the questions, because I'm guessing that a lot of us don't know exactly the kind we have in mind. I think maybe we probably know maybe the kinds we don't like, or sure, why we don't like a knife that we have at home.
Yeah.
But maybe we don't know exactly what it is we're looking for. So how do you get at that?
We like to, this petite chef, it's about a 6.5 inch blade with a little bit of heel, and it's kind of a multi-purpose tool. So if somebody's like, you know, I need something that's going to handle 90% of what I do in the kitchen, we refer to this as our beef stew knife. Think about it. If you're going to make a beef stew, you're going to need to be able to break apart a protein. You know, a big chunk of beef, we need to break that down into chunks. Then you're also going to want to slice your carrots, your potatoes, your onions, dice all that. And so this is the kind of knife that's going to be able to handle most of that. But to a bigger extent, like he says, I mean, what are you going to feel comfortable with? What's the one knife in your kitchen that you're going to want to pick up? And so that's what we need to get to. But this is a pretty good starting point. It's a pretty good general conversation starter, as this shape seems to resonate with a lot of people. Mm-hmm.
And as far as design goes, this is based off of a fairly standard Western chef design. It's kind of a mix between German and French, but it's fairly sleek. It has good balance. It has a little bit of belly, because a lot of people we find are most comfortable with like rock chopping, where they're kind of holding the tip up against the board and they're pushing down. And that's kind of a typical chopping motion that two people do. If they're looking for as you know, some of our chefs are looking for. They're looking for something that has precision, that allows them to slice things, maybe break down a larger cuts of meat, maybe break down fish. So then we can start talking about something like a gyuto. That's what that knife over there is. So a lot of it does come down to, what are you looking to do with your knife? Ultimately, a Western chef versus a gyuto, the differences between them are minor, but they have a lot. They can have an effect on the technique that you use. So that's why we talk about this kind of this Western chef style, this 6.5, 7.5 inch range that most people are very comfortable with. And it's kind of it's a Western chef. You know, it's if they have a Wusthof in their kitchen or whatever, that's what they're familiar with.
That was my next question. Is there a comparison with the types that we might be familiar with? Like you said, a Wusthof, something like that.
Yes, the designs themselves are pretty, across the world are universal in a lot of ways. I mean, there are not a lot of really different ways to design a kitchen knife. There are minor differences, and every maker has those little differences, those little details. But for the most part, again, it's either a profile that's on the flat side or a profile that's got a little more belly. It's, you know, something that's a little thicker in the spine, something a little thinner in the spine. I mean, that's kind of an overgeneralization. But yeah, if someone picks one of these up, it's going to be sort of a more tuned, better feeling version of what they're familiar with. It's not going to be alien in any way. It's just going to be a little bit, you know, we can do it by hand. So there are things that we can do that the robots just aren't capable of really doing.
So what can you do to make it, you know, unique to someone?
Sure. Well, so maybe on top of that point, we do use a different kind of steel. A lot of factory knives that you'll see in your kitchen are made from stainless steels. Mm-hmm. The carbon steel, with the higher carbon content, it will take a better edge. It will hold that edge for longer, meaning it's going to slice better than what you've got in your kitchen. And most factories aren't taking the time to perfect the geometry on their knife. They're just sticking it through a grinder and getting a rough thing and sending it out the door. I mean, we've seen it. People buy brand new knives who, in the market, they're highly respected. But we see them, I mean, fresh from...
from the factory.
Fresh from the factory, and they won't cut.
Yeah.
So... that's what we like to point out to people, is that, yes, these knives are going to cost you more, but there's so much value here. And then we do like to talk about that these are legacy pieces. You know, these are functional works of art. This isn't, you know, a blister pack knife from Walmart so much as it is something that your grandkids are going to fight over. You know, we're creating things that will last. You know, we want to get away from this idea that once something doesn't work for me anymore, we throw it away.
So how do you do that? How do you create the legacy type of knife? You know, you have some beautiful pieces here. Tell me how this goes into creating these.
So again, a lot of that ends up with a conversation where we even send pictures or we show people these are some of the materials that we've used in the past. We're also willing to make man-made laminates out of, burlap sack, or somebody wants us to make a knife out of his dad's old work shirts. And so they're white with blue stripes or something in them, and we're going to make a laminate material out of that. So to his family, that will very specifically be a legacy piece. That would be their grandfather's or great-great-grandfather's T-shirts or whatever, work shirts that went into that. But otherwise, we just try to source, you know, these are not thermoplastic resin, you know, dipped handles or whatever. That's redwood burl that we're going to put maybe with like a mosaic pin or something and some liners in there to make it very unique. And in some cases, people request something specific. We had a guy ask that we use the black walnut tree from his grandfather's property that had fallen down.
That's very cool.
Yeah, so then we took that wood and we cut it down and we stabilized it and we put that into his knife. You know, sometimes that's doable, sometimes it's not. But the idea is that's part of the conversation. How do you want to make this yours? How do do you like a lighter colored wood? Do you like a darker colored wood? Do you want us to mix and match woods? Do you want us to put liner material in there, different colors? And even the etching that you see, we've etched other companies' logos on there. Like, we made a leather knife for someone and we etched their logo on it. Or
Tyner Pond, we did as well. And then we also, we've done some custom pieces too, where we've had it was a Christmas gift for a dad, right? So the mom sent us just a small image of their daughter had wrote Chef Daddy. And so we were able to take that and make Yeah, make a stencil out of that.
That is so sweet.
Permanently affix that to the other side of the knife.
Yeah. Electrochemically etch it into the knife.
So where does the process go? Then, you know, do you send sketches? Do you say, here's what I'm thinking? And they say, well, here's what I'm thinking? Or how does that go?
A lot of it depends on how specific they are at first. If they walk in and they say, I saw this Western chef and that's what I want one of those. Okay. Then off we go. And we just say, do you have a specific handle material that you want? If they say no, then it's up to us. We just make it as cool as we want to make it. If they are unsure or they don't know what handle material, then yeah, we send sketches. We send pictures of these materials. We encourage them to go look at our social media and find ones that we've made in the past. That's actually a pretty good way to do it. They'll send us pictures of other knives that we've made. They say, well, I really like this handle, but I really like this shape. And so, okay, great. We can combine it. We can put this Wenge handle with these brass pins on this knife, and you know, on this knife shape. And then we go off and make it that way to their specifications. So it just totally depends on how specific they are. And in this case, you know, in case of some of these, we have not made a knife like that yet. They don't have that as a reference. They have something similar. They don't exactly want that. So then we redesign it to their specifications. And once everything, you know, works out, then we move to step one. Step one is design. Step two.
Then we start. Yeah.
Yeah, then we start the real work.
We've been talking with Eric Gieseman and Eric Smith of Ash Blades. You can find them at the Indy Winter Farmers Market. Or go to Ash Blades, that's ashblaeds.com, or find them on Facebook. This is Jolene Katzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Thanks so much for tuning into the show this week, and thanks also to our guests. Chris Baggett of Tyner Pond Farm, the Mug and Cluster Truck, Dee Alderman of Graham's Jams, and Eric Gieseman and Eric Smith of Ash Blades. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio.